Let me actually start by thanking the organizers not only for inviting me to talk, but for bringing together this very nice group of people. I think we see that a real community has developed here at the interface between biology and soft matter physics and maybe statistical physics. And it's great to see so many guys having similar interests. So, pardon? And friends. So I would like to talk about different models. So it will be an overview over different models we actually looked into during the last years. And I would like to start with an introduction, which is in the same spirit like Sam just presented to you. And then I will start to go through different models. In the end, I will wrap it up by actually saying a little bit about the respective virtue of the different models we have been investigating. So the introduction starts with the review, which Sam already mentioned. So here we try to actually draw some lessons from soft matter physics. So the idea is that in soft matter physics, we have many interesting model systems, which we understand pretty well. So for all of these four cases, we actually can write down the equations how the object would deform in adhesion on a substrate. But if we take a more general view, we see that none of them actually hits exactly what the cell is doing. Okay, so the first case would be this one. The liquid droplet, which has these Laplace and Young's laws. The second case would be sort of a contact mechanics problem. We have an elastic sphere, which is drawn down by adhesion. It deforms a little bit, but... Ah, okay. So I should put it here. Rising signs. There we go. Maybe I shouldn't turn my head. So the full elastic body, you see immediately that it doesn't deform so much, okay, typically. Vesicles, they make a very large contact area, typically, if the adhesion is strong enough, but nevertheless, it seems to be relatively weak. But nevertheless, you still have a relatively large extension in the third dimension, and then if it comes to capsules, you see that you get buckling and you don't really get a nice adhesion area. Okay, so there, in each of these cases, there's something which really doesn't match what you see with cells. So if you look at cells, they're really different because they achieve somehow to get these very large contact areas if they're on a plane substrate. They develop a lot of tangential forces, something I will talk about in a minute, and they have localized adhesion sites, which you see if you look at the proteins, how they actually move in the interface. So somehow what the cell is doing, really, it adapts itself to the substrate by regrowing itself. So it has many active processes which change the interface completely, and it doesn't have this sort of inert aspect of these systems. Also from each of the systems, we learn a lot about them. Cells are different. Okay, so this is my favorite cartoon, which I always use to explain what are the relevant processes here. First of all, we have this polymerization processes at the rim, which allows the cell to regrow itself on the substrate and to spread out to become relatively flat to actually attain this fried egg morphology you typically see. And then we have this strong contractility, which comes in because the myosin motors are activated and start to pull. And together, these two processes then give very large forces on the substrate. And the point I would like to make here is actually that both processes, the polymerization and the pull by the motors, both lead to an inward force, okay? And the reason is the spatial coordination of the system. So because the actin polymerization always starts here at the cell edge and goes inward, we have an inward flow, the retrograde flow, from the periphery towards the cell body. And this basically slides over the adhesions and creates an inward force. So also we have some pushing against the membrane because the attachment points are behind the membrane. We have an inward force, which looks like a pulling force, okay? So in the, this is one of the reasons why you always see the inward-directed forces, because all the force-generating processes lead to this inward direction, actually. So this is the cartoon we actually use in our review to make this point. You have the network polymerization, which is a little bit like a compressed spring, but it's localized exactly here between the adhesions, which are a little bit away from the periphery, and the membrane, and therefore it gives an inward push, actually. Then you have these motor forces, which are like a tense spring, okay? And together then you get this characteristic inward traction forces, which are, to a first approximation, is an anisotropic force contraction dipole. So this is the main concept we used over the last years to actually describe the system. So here I actually borrowed the cartoon by Xavier. And you see that it basically incorporates the same ideas. So the tense spring here, I mean, sort of, it's of course in this cartoon you pull the rope, but you could also think about the rope pulling back, okay? This would include your motors, and you wonder where the actin flow is, but it's basically here, okay? Because you have this, I mean, these guys are actually pressing against the substrate. It's like a compressed spring, and this is what I would say is the polymerization pressure here, okay? So you have more than one process which actually makes forces, but in the end, you always end up with this characteristic force dipole, and because it's a closed system, you always have a sum of vectorial sum, which has to be zero. Now, this is a nice comparison between two papers, which for me wraps up what's going on here. So on the left-hand side, you see a recent experiment by the group of Eric Dufresne, and what they did is really beautiful. I mean, they actually made a topographic substrate on the bottom, then they topped it with some elastic substrate, so the substrate is flat, but if you put some soft elastic object on it, like a droplet, it will actually feel the difference because it deforms the substrate and it feels the topography below, and they actually start to move and they line up in these grooves here. I mean, grooves in the sense that they can feel the grooves below, okay? It's really an elastic interaction with the environment. Now, if you do the same experiment for cells, and this has been done by Mathis Riele from Glasgow, you basically see that cells behave exactly the other way around, okay? I mean, they tend to go to the stiff parts, so they will go here, and they will actually align because they have this contact guidance. So you see immediately that the what Sam called the dead system will do something very different from the cellular system. Okay, it's in both cases you have a movement towards a region of different stiffness, but in one case it's the soft one, and the other one it's the hard one. Okay, this is this famous phenomenon of durotaxis. So basically, we have to adapt our theories, how we describe the systems, because something is different with cells, okay? And what is different is, of course, regulation. So for example, there is this famous work by Anne Ridley and Alan Hall, where they looked at the way the actin cytoskeleton is actually regulated. And in a very vague sense, you can say there are two main extreme morphologies. There is a regulation, which is going through the small GDPase rug. You get a lot of lamellar podia and small adhesions, and this is basically polymerization of the actin network through up to 3. Or you have this other morphology, which is mainly regulated by rho, another small GDPase, which gives you a lot of stress fibers and very mature adhesions, and this is mainly upregulating the myosin II activity. And this is the difference between the live cell and the dead, between the live system and the dead system, that it has this additional layer of regulation, basically. So it picks up the same signals, but then it works on them in a different way than the dead matter. So this is a paper we actually published last year, which had the purpose to look at the effect of siRNA on cell adhesion. But the reason I show it today is just to show you that we should never forget that there's this additional layer of regulation, okay? So basically what is here is this fight between the small adhesion and the large adhesions, and the main regulatory system might be these two antagonistic players here, the RAC and RHO, which are actually mutually downregulate each other. And this, of course, as a control structure, leads to bistability. Okay, and this is something we see, that we have these two extreme phenotypes which fight each other in some sense. Okay, so the RAC regulates the polymerization, and the RHO regulates the myosin contractility. Okay, so this was my general introduction into the kind of problems we are interested in and the kind of phenomena we look at. Now I would like to briefly mention traction force microscopy, because this is the one technique which is very mature and which allows you to see what's going on at the interface between cells and the environment. The principle has been explained yesterday very nicely by Xavier. So you put beads, typically fluorescent marker beads, into the substrate. You see how they move under the cell traction, and then you actually reconstruct the forces, or in some methods the stresses, but usually the forces, are using elasticity theory, so you have to invert the direct problem of elasticity theory to get the traction forces. So this is a typical example from our collaboration with Margaret Gardell. You see here the actin image of a U2O cell, which has very nice fibers, actually. Then you see the pexillin image, that shows you where the adhesions are, so this is a clear proof where the force is going, because if you now look at the traction force reconstruction, You see that the hotspots and folds are nicely correlated with these proteins, okay? So if we did not see the proteins, we might not actually realize that there's a very close regulation, but in fact, there are very special proteins, the integrins and everything which comes with it, which is actually localized where the traction forces are. And the cell actually uses all this force information at the focal tissues to make decisions about its fate and actions. Okay, you also can extend the traction force microscopy to larger systems. So Xavier uses these very large monolayers. Here there's an example from the work of Mark Gardell, where you have three cells in a row. You see that the traction is actually localized at the ends, and you can make a simple argument on force balance, which actually allows you to reconstruct the forces between the cells, so between this cell and this cell, and here also, there must be some forces across the interface, and you can reconstruct them by implementing overall force balance. This is something we think is always true, okay? And then you see that actually the outer cells are mainly tuck on their environment, while the inner cell actually tucks mainly on its neighbors, okay? And this sort of principle of using force balance elastic equations has been nicely generalized in the work of Xavier to look at very large monolayers, but you also can use it as shown here for smaller clusters. So this is another example for applying this to monolayers. It's a joint collaboration with Joachim Schwarz from Heidelberg. So what you see here is a monolayer which has been shaped into some design, okay? So we use a circular disk with four spikes on it, and then we do the traction force microscopy. And what you see is that you actually create hotspots of traction at these spikes, and you also see some accumulation of traction at the rim of the system. And both of these aspects I will come back to later because we can play in relatively nicely with our theories. Okay. So now I come to the main subject of this talk, which is which kind of models can we actually come up with to understand how force is generated and transmitted through the cell substrate interface. And there's a long list of models which can, in principle, do it. And I would never be able to go through all of them, but I picked out the ones where we worked on, basically. So these are four model types where we recently published. I'm not going to cover the other ones, but of course, the first thing you should actually think about is some kind of polymer model, because we all know that the actin cytoskeleton is basically a cross-linked hydrogel. So I guess that Fred McIntosh later will talk about things like this. So this is, of course, the first thought, if you think about the system, but of course, it will lead to very complicated models, okay? So a sort of reduced model is what we call the active cable model, which I will explain in a minute. This actually motivates us to also look at contour models. Then we could do active gels models, like Jean-Francois talked about yesterday. I rather would like to focus on elastic effects and talk about what we call active elasticity. And then in the end, I will talk about cellular pots models. Similar models would actually be phase-filled or level-set models, which are especially nice if you go to complicated geometries and three dimensions. Okay, let's start with the active cable network. And let me briefly explain why we actually started to work on this. So this was motivated by some work of cell biologists at Karlsruhe who looked at cells on these dot patterns. And you see very nicely how the cells are organized. They have very strong actin structures along the rim. So there are probably many miles and millifilaments here and some also in the cell body. And they pull the cell together and gives it this invaginated shape. We also noted that these shapes are astonishingly geometrical, meaning that they usually are circular arcs, okay? So we were actually aiming at some theory which gives us the circular arc geometry, and we also wanted to explain that these arcs are much larger than these ones. So the basic idea is that we make a mechanical representation of the system, okay? So we say it's pinned at four points. It's some kind of mechanical network. We don't go into the details. We don't use a worm-like chain or anything like this, but we use a simple system like springs, and then we have to put in contractility. There are different ways to put in contractility. You could simply reduce the rest length, but that's not what's happening in the system, okay? So what is happening in the system really is that the myosin moles are pulling all the time. In a static situation, they are probably sort of at the stall force. So the concept we rather decided to use here is actually force dipoles, okay? So we basically distribute many force dipoles in the system, and this contracts it. And we think this is a relatively realistic representation of how the myosin motors are working. Now, if you do this, you get this contracted shape, but you realize immediately that you get relatively flat edges here. And the reason is that you basically have a quadratic reference shape, and as you contract it, you basically compress it. You sum up a lot of compression energy, and this actually makes it to keep its shape, but just a little bit reduced, okay? And it's a problem because this is not what we see in the cells. We don't see these flat edges typically. What we actually see is more invaginated circular edges, and the reason is that there's no real accumulation of compression energy, okay? One reason being that the cell can escape in the third dimension. Another reason being that the actin cytoskeleton is extremely dynamic. It just depolymerizes or slides in, okay? So in order to represent these issues, we basically went to a cable network, which means that if one of these mechanical elements is compressed, it doesn't have any resistance. It only resists to tension, but not to compression. That's sort of the simplest way to actually represent the worm-like chain model in a mechanical network model, okay? And if you do this, you see very nicely these circular features. So we started to look into this. We realized that these network models are extremely flexible, so they give you always these circular arc features. It doesn't matter how you actually create a model. Here, this is a random Voronoi construction. It always gives you the same sort of shapes. So it's relatively independent of the way you actually construct the model, which is nice. And the reason is that it doesn't assume much about the internal workings of this, okay? It's basically everything is contracting, and that's it. Okay, the only thing which is really elastic is the contour, because the contour is stretched between two neighboring points. So this is shown again in this graph. If you use springs, you always get this sort of clear reference shape and the flat edges. If you use the cables, you get this beautiful invaginations, and the reason is there's no real reference state. Okay, the system always pulls, and it's again actually only tensing its contour, but it's not accumulating any compression energy inside. Now this motivated us to look more into contour models, okay? The point is that it's clear that there's some kind of bulk tension, let's call it a surface tension in the system, but what is actually working against it is some kind of elastic stretch energy which you accumulate at a contour, okay, which is not a simple tension. So what we do is we actually introduce some kind of elastic energy in the contour, a line tension, and we balance this with the surface tension pulling in. And if you do the mass, you get an equation which gives you the radius of the contour as a function of the spanning distance, the distance of the two points, and the surface tension which is pulling in. And actually, if you solve this equation or simulate it, you get this kind of relationship here, which looks like a Laplace law. It's inversely related to the tension, but there's also now a dependence on the spanning distance because it's an elastic model. I mean, there's some role for distances here, okay? And surprisingly, there's relatively good agreement between the simple calculation here, the simulation of these networks, and also of the experiments, which I'm not going into for time reasons. But you can show that this relation on D basically bears out in experiments. Now, so far, so good. These are all nice models, but there's one deficiency here, namely that we basically look at dot-like adhesions, okay? And we have seen earlier in the experimental images that cells, of course, achieve a very large contact area, and they have a lot of adhesion mediated by the integrins distributed over the area. So how actually should we proceed if you would like to have coupling to the adhesion area, okay? And I guess it's clear as a theorist that what you need to do is continuum mechanics because you need some distributed force fields. So we actually started to look at minimal models which allow you to look at the distribution of forces over the adhesion area. And I would like to call this the simple, the active elasticity model. So we introduced this in this paper here, but there's beautiful work actually from the Marchetti group, which looked at a very similar model and got basically the same results as we did. So the way it works is you write down the continuum elastic equations for a thin contractile sheet sitting on a substrate. So you basically have the divergence of the stress tensor, which has to be zero, and then you have to put in the traction forces. And the simplest assumption would be to use what the engineers call an elastic foundation, where you say that the traction force is basically a linear to the displacement, okay? Now, in the stress tensor, we have to bring in the driving force. So here we put in an active tension. You can also say a negative pressure. And it's basically the same term like Jean-François was using for his active gels, which in contrast to our systems is flowing. So here we have elasticity. In his case, we had actually viscoelasticity. But this is the real driving force, is this negative pressure here. Then we put in the real boundary condition. So we have zero stress boundary condition here. And we have to implement this somehow. I mean, we can calculate very simple cases, but otherwise we need to do some numerics. So typically you do this in a finite element framework with a PDE tool. There's also a nice implementation by Christiana, where they use actually some particle-based method to do it. Okay, so there are different ways to do it, but typically you would do a finite element implementation. I also note that there's an analogy to thermal cooling where you actually lower the temperature in the metal or something like contracts. This would be exactly the same terms, basically. So let me briefly walk you through a simple application here. So this would be the contractile stripe. What you basically do here is you make a force balance at any point here. You have the F is basically force or the stress. You have the forces at two neighboring points, and you balance this with the traction on the substrate. So if you go to the infinitesimal limit, you have this equation, which is such the elastic equation in 1D. Then you put in the constitutive relationship. So this is the standard one, but you now include this negative pressure or active tension into it. And if you combine these two equations, you see that this actually drops out for the moment being. You get an equation which you can solve right away. It gives you exponential functions. So basically, you get a cinch as a solution. But in order to get the boundary conditions right, you have to put in this active tension. Okay, so this comes in through the boundary conditions. So what you get is basically this. So this is the stripe. In the middle, you have the zero. So displacement is positive on the left-hand side, negative on the right-hand side. And the stress has a zero at the two sides. This is the boundary condition, and it peaks in the middle. If you look at the work by Xavier, you see more or less this scenario. You see that the traction goes up at the sides of the monolayer, and that if you reconstruct the stresses using actually the same equations, you have this very nice peak in the middle of the monolayer. So this is the stripe case, and you can also solve for the disk or the disk as a whole and things like this. But in other cases, which are not so easy, you have to do numerics to get it, actually. So coming back to this experiment I mentioned in the very beginning, this is the cell monolayer, which has a strange shape because we designed it to have the shape. We actually can now apply the model, solve it numerically, and we find exactly this hotspot property that you get a lot of stress accumulation here at this spoke, and you get a little bit of traction accumulation at the rim, very much as you do see it in the traction force microscopy. Okay, so this brings me to the last and fourth model I would like to discuss. So all the models I discussed up to now have this deficiency that they are not really dynamic. Okay, usually you have to know what you are aiming for, okay? And what is not really in there is this protrusive activity of the cells, okay? So we were thinking a lot, how can we actually come up with a model which also allows us to actually propagate out? I mean, very much like Sebastian showed you in the morning, we have these monolayers, they actually move out. At the same time, they are always contractile, okay? But what is missing up to now was this property of the model to actually expand in space, okay? So we started to use cellular POTS models, which have a long tradition, also in applied mass, and where we actually are able to combine these two things, the movement out and the contraction in one model. So I think all of you here are familiar with this. You basically have a spin model. You take a lattice, and if the spin is up, you basically say this is the cell area, and if the spin is down, you say this is outside the cell. So it's a little bit like a vertex model, but you don't work with the interfaces. You really work with pixel-wise representation of the cells. And then you write down a Hamiltonian. You basically define the contour of this cell. You define its area, and you assign tensions to it. So you basically have a contour tension, a line tension, and you have a surface tension, if you wish. And then we can start to put in more elements which we need because we have this more complicated situation. So first of all, we need to actually put in some energy gain if we increase adhesion. So we just put a saturating term here, like a Michaelis Menten, if you wish. So it likes to actually crawl onto an adhesive pattern. And then we can put in additional elements. So in principle, you are relatively free to define what you find interesting from other modeling approaches. Okay. So we basically, for example, use this tension elasticity model I introduced earlier. It's an elastic line tension. And we just put it in. So we have to define where is a peripheral bundle. And then we have to calculate this energy for it and put it into our simulation. And then we just have this overall energy. We do Metropolis dynamics, so it's a relatively, well, it is an extremely fast method, okay? So you can, in within a second, you get very interesting shape minimizations. And you, in principle, it's very modular. I mean, all the models I talked about are modular, but this is extremely modular in the sense that you can, you could even couple it to diffusion fields, reaction diffusion systems, whatever, okay? So because it's so fast, it's much less computational effort than the other models. It's, I really like it to actually explore what cells might do on substrates, okay? So this is an example of, wait a second, there's a movie here. So this I show you to convey you that we really get at the dynamics here. So you see one cell which is crawling onto one of these crossbows. You see that we actually single out these peripheral bundles here and give them some extra energy. That's why we show them in green. I also note that in this model, we don't prescribe cell area. Okay, so in these vertex models, you typically say that you have a reference area you want to go to. We don't do that here. Okay, so the reference area, if you wish, is basically this reference area of the adhesion energy, but it's not that we prescribe the area. Okay, so like in the other models, the ideas that the cell has the third dimension where it can actually push material to or take material from. But we don't put it into the model here because there is really this exchange of material with the third dimension. Okay, so if you look at this shape here, this is what you basically see if you look at the work of Manuel Terry and others, that this is a typically contracted cell on one of these patterns if the pattern size is matched more or less to the cell size, which depends on cell type. So let us look in more detail at this crossbow. Basically, we can now start to actually calculate forces on the substrate, okay? So we do it by using this contour model approach. So we basically look at a point like this one here. We add up the force which comes from the surface tension and the force which comes from the line tension because it's a differential force. It basically comes in with the curvature. This is basically Laplace law. And we then have these edge bundles where we see in the experiment that something special is happening. They're well reinforced. So we put in extra forces using our tension elasticity model. This is what I mean with modular approach, okay? We put in what we know is important, and then we get a relatively well-adapted model for the situation at hand. So we basically can calculate the forces which the model exerts. We then actually use a finite element model to convert this into a displacement of the substrate. And then we are basically at the same point where an experimentalist would be because he measured the substrate deformation, and then he reconstructs, or she reconstructs the forces. So in the next step, we actually reconstruct the forces as if it was an experimental data set, okay? And this is what we then compare to the real data. So this is, for example, reconstructed forces from the labs of Manuel Terry and Martial Ballard from Grenoble. And you see that we get a symmetry right. We don't get this peak here, and there's a lot of, we can discuss why and so on. It has to do with stress fibers, which are not in our model, really. But in principle, what we see is that if you go to through many different shapes, we usually get the overall features of these traction fields right, okay? And the nice thing about this model is that we don't need to know what a cell is doing. We just let a cell start somewhere, and as you see, it will crawl automatically onto the pattern and in a very fast computational time. So there are two more examples here where you see the dynamics of this. So we just put the cell somewhere close to the pattern. It will crawl onto it. We can actually look at the traction fields. And in fact, this is experimentally a very hard, challenging thing to do. So we have no experiments to compare to. But the end result, this has been measured, and this looks usually pretty reasonable. Okay, so as an example which has not been in the literature before, this is a cross, and you get this very nice symmetric traction pattern. Okay, so let me now step back a little bit and conclude by looking at the different model classes I looked at. I think it's clear that in such a complicated situation like cell adhesion to a substrate, There is no single model which will do everything, okay? It depends on the purpose at hand, the kind of experiments you are interested in. So we have to be basically very adaptive, flexible, and find the right model for the purpose at hand. So all of these models are fine, okay? They have all disadvantages and advantages. So what I try to explain is that these active cable networks are surprisingly good in representing, first of all, the polymer nature of the cytoskeleton, and second, the way these force dipoles work in the cell. We use them to explain cell shape, and we got some nice agreement regarding the dimensions of the systems, the role of the spanning distance. They motivated us to look into contour models, which of course have the advantage that you can do a lot of nice calculations. Okay, there are many results from differential geometry you can use, so you can got a lot of interesting results. But of course, they're relatively coarse-grained because they don't represent all the details of the system anymore. This is easier to put in such a more detailed model. Then the active elasticity means that we use a continuum approach. This is extremely good or extremely appropriate, I would say, if you look at very distributed force fields. It's exactly what we have in traction force microscopy. So I think that the active elasticity, like the active gels, they fit very nicely if you have traction force microscopy data you would like to explain. And in principle, you can make these models very detailed. You can put in more local features, like local contractility. We've seen this yesterday. Jean-François's talk on the cytokinesis, where you really put in the constriction ring in a very defined location. So you can do this here as well, like, let's say, the endpoint of a stress fiber or something like this. And finally, we looked at the cellular pots model, which has a big advantage that it is a dynamical model, which actually makes the computational cell to expand, which is not in the other models, okay? But of course, there are certain features like this coupling to the area, which is not really in this model here. So let me mention my collaborators here. So the single cell traction force microscopy is basically work with the group of Margaret Gardell. And Benedict Sabas wrote most of the computer code we're using in this context. Then the cell monolayers, this was a collaboration at Heidelberg with Joachim Spatz in his group. And all the computer code came from Jérôme Souanet in my group, including the thermal elasticity. Then the work on the cell shape was actually done together with Martin Bastmeier at Karlsruhe, and the theory was done by Ilka Bischofs-Pfeiffer. And then we also continued to work on these active cable networks. The active elasticity, this was work with Karina Edwards-Dunlop, who's now at London. And the new work on the cellular pots model is the work of a PhD student at Heidelberg, Philipp Alberts. Thanks for your attention.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Metropolis dynamics.
So you don't belong very much by the dynamics?
Well, yes. It basically, like in the vertex models, assumes that the Hamiltonian is fine, okay? So it all depends on how good your Hamiltonian is chosen in regard to the system. I agree. It's a firm logical approach.
I have a question about, it seems that most of the models that you've displayed have a feature that as the cell exerts more force on adhesive points, that it sort of gets these nice sort of angles that get tighter from the models. In other words, you start out with something, you know, that the null hypothesis is that it's sort of some sheet, and then as it exerts more forces on point contacts, you get a more acute angle, let's say.
Yeah.
I was talking to people that work on, say, like cardiomyocytes or something like this, and then in that case, it's the exact opposite. The more tension, let's say you have a pattern, the more, and you have a myocyte, the more tension that it exerts, the less acute the angle becomes.
Okay.
The question that I have then is that what goes wrong with these types of models in other words, it seems you're making some sort of assumption with these models that there's some inherent initial shape. I know that you said that there's no reference state, but
there's
some assumption there that there's some inherent state, and then for most cell types, the angles get more acute. But if you have a myocyte which starts out acute, then it becomes less acute. The angle does as it exerts, as more tension it gets exerted on the substrate.
So I don't quite agree with what you were saying. Okay, I mean, of course, if there's more tension, the system will invaginate more. But if you now talk about the force at a certain point, which you might measure on the substrate, it really depends on the geometry you look at. Okay, this is why the micro patterns are so nice, because you can basically manipulate this. So let me explain this with an example. Okay, so here we actually use our contour model, and we first actually know that if you look at a single point like this point up here, the surface area will play no role, because it's basically not pulling on a point. Okay, it only pulls on a line element. Which means that the only force which is pulling here is actually this lambda, okay, the line tension. And the next thing you see is that the lambda actually, it really depends on the shape of these two arcs here, how much the lambda balances each other out, it cancels each other out, or how much is really transmitted to the substrate, okay? So only the part of the vector which is going downwards actually will appear on the substrate, and all the other stuff will cancel each other out, okay? So the lesson here is that a lot of the forces which are inside cells, they will never arrive at the substrate, because they have to go through, if they have to go through this kind of point-like things, okay? Now, if it comes to the question how much of this force is going through to the substrate, it really depends on the arc shape, and the arc shape in turn depends on first of all the tension. So this is how the surface tension enters the game. Okay, it determines the shape, and it depends on the shape the cell has. Okay, where's the next adhesion point? So if this point was up here, you would actually cancel this completely, and you would not see it. Okay, only if this point is down here, you will have an arc going this way, and the two lambdas will go more or less in the same direction. So it really depends on the details, okay? So maybe what you're saying is specific to cardiomyocytes, which have a very specific shape in this experiment, where this cancels out, and then you don't see it, okay? Maybe. I don't know the experiment, but you have to be careful. It really depends on the details. And I think that a lot of forces is actually canceled out before you see it on the substrate. So this is why I think it's really a big challenge to have more intracellular stress sensors, because you have a more immediate way to see the forces. On the substrate, you only see the vectorial sum, which is eventually going through, okay? So you lose a lot of information. I mean, laser cutting is another way to get these forces which are inside, but as we all know, laser cutting has also its problems, okay? But in principle, it's of course always better if you have something inside the cell than just the substrate.
Well, I also have a question sort of along similar lines. If I got it right, the models are all two-dimensional, essentially,
yes.
Right? Would you want to speculate what happens when you have a shell model and an elastic shell that has a third dimension?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I tried to say that already. The point is, I think that in this field, it's actually good to be two-dimensional and to treat the third dimension as a reservoir for material, okay? I think in the moment you go to three dimensions, you are basically forced to deal with the volume issue, okay? And that's, like we heard in Dave's talk, okay? That's a complicated issue. I mean, you have to talk about osmotic pressures and things like this. So I'm actually pretty happy to stay in two dimensions and to treat it the third dimension as a reservoir. I think if you go to three dimensions, it will be much more complicated.
But you have to deal with some
physical questions which we avoid here.
It's a technical problem maybe, but are you losing something essential? I don't quite know how to think about it yet. By not being in the third dimension.
What I'm saying is basically, of course, I could use these models and just go to three dimensions. I could just wrap an elastic shell. That's what you think about, I guess, okay? And then I would get, of course, the effect of this. The rim would be very different, would accumulate a lot of stress, and I probably have to do more flow-related problems and so on, okay? But the problem is I also had to talk about global properties which I'm not sure about, okay? What is the overall volume regulation? What is the area regulation? I'm not sure about this, but in this way, we somehow managed to circumvent it. So in this sense, I'm really happy about the 2D models. Okay. No.
No.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. No. Really nice talks. My question is, how would you extend this to multicellular situations? So you've modeled the adhesion to the substrate quite well, but what I have not seen much models here is how to incorporate the cell-cell contacts and the effect in multicellular assemblies. A lot of the force will localize on the outside of the cluster.
Yeah, so I think we have already seen some models. I mean, I think a large part of the community is using particle-based models, like we've seen in Pascal Silbersand's talk. And if you are more interested in really cell shell junctions, you typically go for the vertex models, which Lisa talked about. Mm. So I think there is a real choice of models. In the spirit of our active elasticity, it's actually more meant to be a tissue model than a single cell model, okay? Because it assumes a very homogeneous situation. And I mean, the first instance where it was used is actually more the cell monolayers. You can go to single cells, but of course you have to worry about the heterogeneities in a single cell, okay? So I think there's no conceptual problem to come up with models for multicellular systems. Also, the cellular pots model is very easily generalized to multicellular systems.
Well, Ulrich, so how literally should we take this tug of war business? Because yeah. in that picture where you have two pullers, right? If you cut the rope, yeah. two groups of people will fall down.
Yeah.
But oftentimes in the cell, one group of pullers is on the focal adhesion, but the other end of that string is somehow lost in a crowd.
Yeah, I agree.
Is how big of an issue is that in these models?
It's a big issue, but I mean, this is only a one-dimensional model. Okay, if you cut it, it's gone, basically. I use the example of the monomer layer stripe, because this is more or less a 1D situation. But of course, it's a 2D situation, okay? I mean, I think that Stefan Grill will probably talk about laser cutting of the cortex. And then you see very nicely, if you cut, you open up this sort of wound, okay? And of course, the connectivity is kept by all the surrounding. So, I mean, if you're interested, we did some recent work where we actually look at the difference between different stress fibers. So there are the dorsal stress fibers, which go into the cytoskeleton and are basically dispersed. And there are the more ventral stress fibers, which go really from one point to the other. And this is something we model. So we can put this into our cable network because it's a really modular model. We can put in additional cables and we can choose how we connect them to the rest of it, okay? So the way I look at this is that the cell is pervaded by a network of actin, which we really don't see because it's low resolution. But then we have these condensed structures in it, okay? And if you cut one of those, the stress is distributed in this other background matrix, if you wish. Okay? And this is the way I think about these systems. But you're completely right. I mean, it's not one-dimensional. I mean, only stress fibers are really one-dimensional objects.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to Silke's question, reply to Silke's question. I mean, of course, if your cells are strongly interacting, you can actually use this continuum model to describe the forces and stresses of a cell monolayer. And people, we have done this, and some other people have done this, and even to some extent to describe the collective migration. And you can even incorporate the effect of cell-cell coupling to some extent, or how those can be weakened, and you actually get surprisingly good agreement with experiments, almost better than one should, I think, sometimes. So that was just that. But then I also have a question about your pulse model, sort of going back to Jean-Francois' question. It seems to me the dynamics you're looking at perhaps is the dynamics of how the cells proceeds to adhere to the pattern, which all the other models don't incorporate because the cell has already adhered. They're completely static models. But have you thought over, have you tried to actually use this model to actually describe real dynamics, meaning cell migration of the type that Pascal or Javier mentioned?
It's of course, a very good question. So, I mean, first of all, the way I showed it today, it's basically driven by local gain in adhesion energy, which I think is a good first assumption, okay? But what is really missing is something like the concept of a lamellar podium. So we were actually playing around with the idea that we take the convexity of the contour to make a decision where a lamellar podium appears, and then we have to give it some persistency, okay? So I think these are the main ingredients one needs here. I mean, the point is that if a lamellar podium comes up, it actually persists for some time. This is the inertia issue we discussed yesterday, okay, before it decays. And you have to put this into the model to get realistic agreement with how cells spread on substrates. And we are basically trying that as well. Okay, so I didn't talk about it, but it's doable.
Okay. Would you say that what is missing is polarization?
Yes. And the regulation behind it, okay, the rugby. I mean, you made very nice work on the fingers, where you couple it basically to a diffusion field. This would be doable here as well.
Thank you.